he puzzled something out. Never watch his quick changeover from watchfulness to merriment as she said something that made him laugh. Never see the surprised wonder in his eyes as he kissed her and pulled back to stare down at her and find that her expression matched his own. There were moments she hated her brother Torin, but not enough to risk his life. Rosary recovered some of her usual animation, though it was clear she was still mulling something over. The days were cold but sunny, so Astira and Eleanor worked in the gardens, clearing out the old stalks and roots and whispering secrets. There was a young guard named Dakin from a half-noble family in Brassenthwaite. He was lonely and homesick and so very sweet. He and Astira had been meeting in secret down by the barracks. It was wrong. Astira knew it was wrong, and yet she was so fond of him. She would be circumspect. No one would find out. Didn't Eleanor think it would be all right as long as they didn't allow the situation to go too far? I am the wrong one to ask for advice, Eleanor thought. Just be careful, she said. What will the Lestra do if she finds you've been consorting with a guard? Astira shook her head. I don't know. Will I be thrown out of the convent? Will he? I know there have been indiscretions before. You always hear stories, but no one ever says what happened. Just be sure you know what you're risking, Eleanor said. Make sure it's worth it. Eleanor was tempted, but she resisted the urge to reciprocate with her own confessions. Bad enough to trade kisses with one of the Lestra's own guards, who at least professed to love the goddess and belonged inside the convent walls. But to play at romance with some idle stranger, about whose background you knew nothing at all, even the love-struck Astira would cavil at that. Leah stuck her head out of the kitchen window, which overlooked the garden. Can you two come help? The supply horses have arrived, and there's no one else in the kitchen, and I can't carry everything in by myself. Always glad of an excuse to get away from gardening, Astira and Eleanor jumped to their feet. They're late, Astira observed. I noticed we were running low on flour. Pack horses came every 3 or 4 weeks from Neft, a small caravan of 5 or 6 animals led by a couple of freighters. Eleanor supposed wagons, which would have been more efficient for hauling bulk quantities, couldn't force their way through the overgrown forest path. Of course, the daughters grew and canned some of their own produce within the compound, and the soldiers often hunted for fresh meat, but there were necessities they relied on the city to supply. Are they out front? Eleanor asked. It was a tedious chore to carry baskets and bags all the way from the courtyard through the great receiving hall and down progressively narrower corridors to the large kitchen at the rear of the main house. Leah shook her head. I told them to come around back, she said a little defensively. Astira looked reproving. You know the guards don't like it if they can't see visitors from the gate. It's 2 men and 7 horses. I think we're safe. Anyway, my foot hurts. I can't walk that far 20 times in the next 2 hours. Eleanor smothered a laugh. From around the side of the building, she could hear the sound of horse hooves clopping on the dry dirt, and a man's voice raised in a soothing tone. Easy there, girl. Just a shadow. Come on. You've made it this far. That's right. She saw a stocky, middle-aged man round the corner, leading a skittish gray horse by the bridle. It was late in the day, and the bulk of the convent itself instantly covered him in shadow, but Eleanor could see him clearly enough. Behind him were 3 horses on a lead rope. The rest of his party had not yet pulled into view. Astira was eyeing him with some disfavor. That one seems too high-strung to be a pack horse, she said. Eleanor grinned. At times like this, Astira's haughty, noble roots were most evident.
Her first time out. Well, second, the freighter grunted. She'll get quieter. Here, is there some place we can tie them up while we start to unload?
Eleanor and Astira hurried forward to help situate the animals. Leah turned to greet the second man as he stepped into sight, leading his own string of horses. The first man started unbuckling straps on one of his pack horses and hoisted a canister of flour out of a pouch, handing it to Eleanor.
"It's heavy," he warned.
"I've got it,"
she replied, and pivoted back toward the kitchen. And then she almost dropped the canister in a moment of dizzy shock. The second freighter was standing by his lead horse, securing the reins, but he glanced her way as she turned. It was Justin. Chapter 19. It was impossible to speak to Justin. Impossible to look as if she wanted to speak to him, with so many other people around. Not just the novices and the other freighter, but within 5 minutes, two convent guards who showed up to oversee this interaction between the novices and city folk. But Eleanor was acutely aware of him. Every gesture he made, every word he uttered, every glance he sent her way. How could he come here? How could he? Perhaps there was no risk to it, not really, for all sorts of visitors came to the convent and left again and didn't make a ripple in their calm lives. But there was something about Justin that was not calm. There was an inherent challenge in the way he stood, in the way he carelessly swung bundles down and settled them into Leah's arms or Astira's, in the way he looked around, really looked, as if curious to know the exact layout of the compound, the square footage given over to gardening, the number of guards visible on the walls, in the way he gazed at her when she had the courage to glance his way. "You might stay away from me," his expression seemed to say, "but I will not stay away from you." It terrified her. It exhilarated her. Sweet mother, look at his face, alive with laughter at something his companion had said. Watch the way he tossed back his fair hair. See his muscles bunch under his shirt, then smooth out as he handed over his burden. She was almost staring at him, despair and longing in her face. She forced herself to glance away. The freighter was squinting up at the sky and wearing an expression of concern. "Be dark in an hour or two," he said. "We got such a late start. Not a chance we'll make it out of the forest by nightfall." He handed Eleanor a heavy, shifting bag, dried beans, maybe. She altered her grip on it, pretending she didn't have a secure hold, and then set it on the ground and adjusted her robes. She wanted to hear the rest of this conversation. "You afraid of traveling in the dark, Jenkins?" one of the convent guards asked, sounding amused. "Even when the moon's practically whole?" "Damn it, I am," Jenkins replied a little ruefully. "Almost got killed by a wolf one night, 3-4 years back. Ever since, I just don't care for journeying by moonlight." "Room in the barracks," the other guard said thoughtfully. "You couldn't go roaming, though." "No, no, we'd stay put," Jenkins said. "Well, you could step outside the building, maybe as far as the training yard, no farther." "You sure about this?" the first guard objected. "Don't recall that we've housed visitors before." "Oh, sure. Mostly in winter, when the roads are bad and daylight's so short. You can check with Coben first if you want, though." "I think I'd better." He hurried off toward the back of the compound, where the barracks and the training yard could be found. "Don't worry," the remaining guard said nonchalantly. "You can stay the night."
"Thanks. I appreciate it."
Jenkins glanced at Justin.
"That do for you? Do you need to hurry home? Forgot to ask."
Justin shook his head.
"I'm clear. Not expected back till tomorrow afternoon."
Eleanor thought she didn't draw a single breath during the next 15 minutes, as she and the other girls carried bundles into the kitchen, then went back outside for more, and everyone waited for final word on whether the visitors could spend the night. Finally, the first guard came jogging up, his expression relieved.
"Coben says they can stay," he reported. "Bunk in the barracks. Eat with us, too." "Good news," the freighter said. "Damn, it'll be dark in an hour. I hate winter. Don't mind the cold so much, but I can't stand the dark."
Eleanor, who all this time had helped Jenkins unload his pack horses, now turned casually toward Justin's string and watched as he hauled down a package wrapped in brown paper. It was solid but not too heavy, a round of cheese, she thought. She held her arms out for it, and he carefully handed it over. She allowed her eyes to lift to his face for just a second, knowing he would be watching her, waiting for her signal. "Midnight," she mouthed. He nodded infinitesimally and turned instantly away, pulling out something else from his saddlebags. Eleanor carried the cheese into the kitchen and stood there a moment, shaking. If her heart were to beat any faster, any harder, it would hammer its way out past her ribs and she would die of fear right here, right now. Fear and excitement. It was a simple matter for Eleanor to leave the courtyard with all the other novices who had formed the moon shape, tonight just a sliver past full, and step inside the building with the rest of them. Simple for her to mention that she was hungry and head on back toward the kitchen while the others turned for the stairs. Any number of people were still awake in the convent at midnight. They were, after all, women who worshipped a night goddess. Some of their prayers and rituals could only be performed in the darkest hours. The Lestra, it was said, often stayed awake the whole night through, scribbling in her study or wandering the grounds under the direct eye of the Silver Lady. Surely Eleanor did not want to run into her. So she cloaked herself in a veil of secrecy, the Black Mother's gift, and drifted through the hallways like an only slightly corporeal shadow. Now and then she heard voices, a few rooms back, and footsteps from overhead or down another hallway, but she did not encounter anyone. The kitchen was empty, and the door yielded silently to her hand. No one stood in the denuded garden, breathing in the star-chilled air. No one lurked along the pathways that connected the great hulking structure of the convent proper to the scattering of buildings in the back of the compound, where the guards were housed and the horses were kept, where novices were not supposed to go. Justin would not have strayed far from the barracks, a long, low, utilitarian building that looked out over the training yard. If he had managed to win free at all, which he might not have, he would have stuck close to the territory outlined for him as permissible. This was hardly the time and place to go exploring, no matter how curious he might be about his surroundings. If a guard came across him, outdoors at this hour, he would have to appear as innocent as possible. But he might not have been able to creep out. He might have been too closely watched. He might not have the skills of stealth that came so naturally to her. He might not be there at all. But he was. She saw him before he saw her, even though she was moving and he was standing still. He was leaning against the slatted fence that enclosed the training yard, staying as close to the stables as he could to take advantage of what cover the building afforded. He was in profile to her, so that half his attention could be on the barracks in case anyone was searching for him, and half of it could go toward listening for her approach. She paused a moment, just to take the chance to truly look at him. Drink in the sight of the face that she had been so certain she would never see again. Sweet mother, when had he become so dear to her? When had she fallen in love with him? She moved closer, silently, she thought, but he turned his head as if a sound had caught his notice. She could see his eyes scanning all approaches. He even looked straight at her. But the goddess's power was stronger than human eyesight. He could not see her. Eleanor stepped closer, even more daintily, and saw a frown cross his face. He was concentrating so hard that he could hear her slippered feet in the brown grass, or her breathing, or her heartbeat. He knew she was near. But she was still invisible to him as she placed a hand on his arm and spoke his name. She had thought to startle him, but she guessed wrong. His hand closed over hers, and he drew her against him so swiftly she didn't even have time to gasp. She loosed and reformed her night-dark cloak, and now he was standing inside it with her, both of them, safe from the eyes of outsiders, sheltered in the arms of the goddess. "Eleanor," Justin said, and bent in to kiss her. She couldn't help herself. She pressed herself into that kiss as if he was light and air, and she had been deprived of both for a lifetime. Only for a moment. She pulled back hard, her hands against his chest. He caught her by the shoulders before she could move too far away. "Justin, what are you doing here?" she demanded in a furious whisper. "Don't you know how dangerous it is?"
"Dangerous how?" he shot back, raising his chin and showing every evidence of stubbornness. "A man asks if he can hire me to help deliver goods, and I accept on good faith, and I do my part of the job. I'm here, and no one cares that I'm here. What's wrong with that?"
She stared at him in the dark. His face was as clear to her as if they were standing under a noon sun. "Don't pretend," she whispered. "You came here to see me. Don't pretend you didn't." He grinned.
"Well, of course. Wouldn't have taken the job if you weren't here. But I didn't do any harm by coming."
She wanted to hit him or shake him or scream out her fear and fury. But the first two options wouldn't have budged him, and the last would have had dire consequences. "Justin, you can't come here to see me. You can't. You have to stay away from me. You have to stay away from the convent." He shrugged.
"Well, I won't. I want to see you. I want to know you're all right. You don't have to talk to me. You don't have to meet me in the middle of the night. Just stand in the window or the courtyard or the kitchen garden and let me get a look at you. Make sure you're still breathing and you've got no broken bones, and I'll deliver my goods and mount back up on my horse and ride on out."
He would, too. She could tell by the set of his mouth, his obdurate stance. This was a man it was impossible to turn aside once he had decided on a course of action. What would he do, what would he say, when she told him she could never see him again? She could not have that conversation, now, tonight, on the convent grounds, with so many hostile parties so close and probably wakeful. She could not warn him away, she could not lie to him, she could not make him believe that she did not love him. "You shouldn't have come," she said, but now her voice was gentle, full of some of the wonder she felt. That he would come so far, just for a glimpse of her, just to assure himself that she was safe. "Whoever you are, I can't rid myself of the feeling that you are no friend to the Lestra, and that she and her men would do something terrible to you if they found you inside this compound." Now his face showed amusement.
"I was here once before, and they didn't like me much then," he admitted. "But I'm being more careful this time."
"You can't come back."
"Then you have to come to Neft."
She shook her head. "I have no control over that."
"Then I'll be here again. Look for me."
"Justin," she said, having absolutely no idea how to finish the sentence, but she didn't have to. He pulled her back into his embrace and kissed her, and she lost any interest in forming a coherent sentence. Nothing mattered, except his arms around her body, his lips against her mouth. Nothing moved, nothing breathed, nothing lived, except the two of them in their dark and secret circle. Eventually, they broke apart, just a little, pulling back just enough to watch each other's face. It was cold enough that they actually needed each other's body heat to stay warm. Idly, they began to talk, sharing the tales of their recent days. More friends of Justin's had passed through Neft, and he was careful not to use their names, for some reason, but she got the impression one of them was a woman. Oddly, she didn't feel the same hot jealousy she had felt when he mentioned the beautiful Kira. Maybe he had a different relationship with this particular woman, or maybe Eleanor no longer worried that Justin's heart was bestowed elsewhere. She told him about Rosary and her unnerving desire to offer a sacrifice to the Pale Mother. Is she the kind of person who just talks about things and never does anything, or is she the kind who follows through? He wanted to know. Follows through? Usually in the most dramatic fashion possible. Then nothing you say is going to be able to stop her. Just step back. Don't let her drag you with her into whatever conflagration she starts. Better advice than she had been able to give herself, and she was comforted by his practical words. Imagine how restful it would be to always rely on Justin to help her solve problems, big and little. I'll hope that this time it's a small and personal fire, she said, choking. He had loosened her braid so that her hair fell free all the way past her waist, and now he was stroking his hand slowly, rhythmically down her back, allowing plaits of hair to slip through his spread fingers. He had done the same thing back in Neft. He seemed fascinated by the feel and texture and pattern of her hair. It doesn't sound to me like she's going to be ready to leave the convent any time soon, he said, his voice as slow and deliberate as his caress. Would you be willing to leave without her? If you decided you wanted to? If you became uneasy enough about unfolding events? I don't know, she replied. She rested her forehead against his chest, feeling the chilled leather of his coat smooth against her cold skin. He smelled like horse and sweat and something indefinable, maybe just himself. My family might not want me to leave her behind, and I would find it hard to abandon her, I admit. She doesn't always make good decisions. Without someone to watch her, her choices might be even worse. Well, it's something you should start thinking about, he said, how you can leave the convent. And if you won't walk out without her, how you can persuade Rosary to come too. I've thought about writing a letter to my father, she said, to tell him it's time to bring us home, but I'm not sure... Well, it's possible the Lestra has our mail read. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but...
But it would seem entirely in character, he finished up. I can take a letter for you and send it on its way. And then be struck dumb when he realized it was directed to her family in the Lirans.
I don't have one ready just at the moment, she said, forcing a light laugh. Perhaps I will by the next time I see you.
And that will be when?
I told you, I don't know.
In 4 or 5 weeks, maybe, he said, if I bring in your next supply of goods. She was alarmed.
Justin, won't it seem strange if you keep showing up here? Won't someone notice? He shrugged.
Far as I can tell, Jenkins has been hauling goods in for the past 6 months, and no one seems concerned about him. No one should pay any attention to me as long as I behave myself.
She lifted a hand to his mouth and traced the full lips. And this is what you call behaving yourself? She murmured. Seducing novices under the moonlight? He caught her hand in his and pressed a kiss into the palm.
And this is what you call seduction? He asked. I must have missed part of it.
She giggled and tried to free her hand, but he held on tighter, sliding his other arm around her waist to hold her in place. His lips moved from her palm up to her fingertips, back to her palm, and down to her wrist. The sleeves of her robe fell back. Her moonstone bracelet slid down her arm toward her elbow, every glowing gem hot against her skin. His mouth paused in its travels, and his hand closed with unexpected pressure around her fingers. Ow, Justin! Now he lifted his head and twisted her arm so he could try to see it, but the light was too poor. His grip shifted. He ran his fingertips back and forth over the rough patch of skin encircling her entire wrist.
What's this? He asked, his voice quiet but holding a note that struck her as ominous.
As if he believed someone had offered her great physical harm and he was determined to discover who. and then set off on a mission to strangle that person or run him through with a sword. She tried without success to pull her hand away. What's what? His finger, for a moment, pressed harder against the band of roughened skin. This. You've got a scar around the base of your hand. Feels like... doesn't feel like a knife wound, so I guess nobody tried to slice your hand off. Feels more like a burn. She sighed and stopped tugging on her hand. His fingers continued investigating, gentle now, checking for the extent of damage. That's what it looks like, too. I wear my sleeves long so it doesn't show, and most of the time I try to keep the bracelet off my skin, wearing it outside the cloth of my robe, but sometimes it... Wait, he interrupted. Wait. Are you saying your bracelet is burning you? Your moonstones are hot to the touch? She felt her heart skip in sudden fear. He knew something she didn't, and he was suddenly deeply alarmed. Yes, she said cautiously. I just assumed... Aren't they always? Don't they burn everybody? Now he was staring at her in something like horror, and it took her a moment to realize he was not terrified by her, but for her. The touch of a moonstone only bothers people with magic in their blood, he said, his voice low and urgent. A moonstone will only burn your skin if you're a mystic. Chapter 20 Justin and Jenkins accomplished virtually the entire trip back to Neft without saying a word. The freighter attempted a few conversational gambits, but gave up when Justin didn't respond. Even their stops for food along the way were passed in silence. Not until they reached Jenkins's barn and property on the edge of town did Justin rouse himself to speak. "If you need me again, I'd be happy to ride out with you next time you're going to the convent," he said, as the freighter counted into his hand the money he'd promised for the job. "Got a trip up toward Knockland Towers later in the week?" Jenkins said hopefully. Justin shook his head. "Not interested in any route except the one to Luminon." If Jenkins thought that odd, he gave no outward sign. "Well, I might need you at that. I'll let you know. Appreciate it." Justin hiked over to the stables to tell Dells he was back and ready to work. Indeed, he shoveled manure and hauled down hay with more vigor than most men would have mustered after a long ride and a virtually sleepless night. But he had to work off some of the ferocious energy building up in his muscles. His body had braced itself for combat and now had to launch itself into action or explode. A mystic. By the grace of the Bright Mother, a mystic in Luminon Convent? That explained Eleanor's ability to heal sick old Paulina Gieseltess. That explained her eerie skill at practically making herself disappear. That explained almost all of the mysteries about her, but added a whole new layer of conundrums. She hadn't believed him. "Justin, don't be ridiculous. I'm not a mystic. I scarcely even understand what that means." He had tried to explain. "A mystic is merely someone who has been granted magic by the gods, and surely you have." But she just shook her head and laughed. "I'm not a mystic. I'm an ordinary woman." In the end, it didn't matter if she believed him or not. If she acknowledged that her power was in her own blood and not granted on a random basis by a careless goddess. What mattered was that she understood how much danger she was in now. Real, mortal, immediate danger. "If the Lestra sees this burn on your arm," he had told her, speaking slowly and deliberately, "if she knows it was caused by your moonstones, she will believe you are a mystic. If she believes you are a mystic, you will die. Do you understand me, Eleanor? She is on a campaign to systematically eliminate mystics from the realm. It will not stop her that you say you have no magic. It will not stop her that you say you didn't know. Nothing will stop her. She will kill you. You will be dead. Do you understand me?" She had understood. She had believed him, and she was frightened. all good things. But she would not, even so, agree to leave as soon as she could gather her clothes and slip out into the darkness. He had urged her to leave right then, that very night, creep past the guards at the gate and loiter in the forest until Justin and his companion could pick her up as they left the next morning. "You could sneak out. I've seen what you can do. No one would know you were leaving," he argued. But she would only shake her head. "No, Justin, no. I'm not ready to leave yet. I've kept my secret for a whole year, and I didn't even know I had a secret to keep. Now I'll be twice as watchful. I won't make any mistakes."
"Everybody makes mistakes," he said.
He had regarded her speculatively by moonlight, trying to decide if he could take her by force, steal a horse and escape with her this very night. His mood favored the plan, but his cooler intellect recognized it as suicidal.
"I won't. I'll be fine. Just trust me."
Since he'd had no choice, he had left her behind. But he was already scheming about how and when to return and what sorts of persuasions he could bring to bear when he did. He would go back with the freighting man. That was a dead certainty. Maybe sooner if he could think of a way to get inside the compound. Sweet Mother of the Burning Sun, Eleanor was a mystic. She could not have found a more dangerous place to stand if she had searched every acre and plot in the entire country of Gillengarria looking for one.
"You've been quiet lately," Faber remarked to him two nights later as the magistrate joined Justin in the tap room.
Justin was almost done with his meal and couldn't have said what he'd eaten. He had no attention to spare for inessential details these days. He only bothered to eat because he intended to keep himself as strong, as ready for action, as humanly possible. He didn't make much effort at a smile. He was finding it hard to keep up this game of pretending to be harmless.
"You'd rather I started breaking tables and throwing chairs through windows?"
"I'm thinking you've done some damage in your time."
Justin shrugged and took a swig of ale. He didn't particularly care if Faber thought him rude. Who cared what anybody thought about anything? Eleanor was in danger.
"Not lately," he said.
"Not so sure about that,"
Faber said in a soft voice. Now Justin gave him a quick, level stare out of narrowed eyes.
"What have you heard about me?"
Faber settled himself more comfortably in his chair. Clearly, Justin's hostility wasn't having much of an effect on him.
"There was a story some weeks back. Fancy house burned down a few miles up the road in Auckland territory."
"And you think I had something to do with it?"
Faber shook his head.
"I think it was burned down by convent guards trying to smoke out mystics," he said bluntly.
Plain speaking for someone as roundabout as Faber, Justin remained noncommittal.
"Is that right?"
"Trouble is, they seem to have missed their target," he said. "Young boy was staying at the house. Everyone thinks he's got magic in his blood. Everyone thought he died in the fire. Turns out he didn't. Story I heard just today is that some stranger happened to be riding by, and he helped the youngster get clear of the soldiers, turn the boy over to people who could be trusted. Never told anyone his name."
Who would have expected nobility to be gossiping with the magistrate of Neft?
"Depending on how you feel about mystics, that was a stroke of either good fortune or bad," Justin commented.
"I think the young Saramara who's running Nocklin thought it was good fortune," Faber said. "Sarah Mava? That boy's related to her somehow, and she's very fond of him. She was ecstatic to get the news, they say."
"Well, that's interesting," Justin replied. "What about you? Pleased or disappointed?"
Faber stretched out his legs.
"I'm not one who sanctions outright murder," he drawled. "I can think of a few men I'd like to see dead, but I wouldn't set their houses on fire in the middle of the night."
Which was as close as Faber had ever come to admitting he disapproved of the persecution of mystics. Still, that didn't mean Justin should share his own views. He wasn't ready to trade confidences just yet.
No, Justin said. If I'm going to kill someone, I want him to be armed and staring me straight in the face.
Faber chuckled.
Just the sort of thing I'd expect you to say, he said. Even so, I have to wonder why you were out roaming the countryside the night that house burned down.
Justin grew very still.
Who says I was?
No one. It just seemed to me like the man who saved that boy sounded an awful lot like you, from the description I heard.
Well, I can tell you this, Justin said with a little more heat than he'd intended. Anyone who had been riding around that night and did happen to see that boy running from the fire should have helped him to safety. Doesn't take a good man to do something like that. Takes a bad man not to.
I didn't think you'd admit it, Faber said, satisfaction in his voice. He sighed heavily and climbed to his feet as if the act took a great deal of effort, but he lingered a moment before walking away.
It wouldn't hurt you to trust me, he said quietly. Sometime, if you needed to.
How do you know you can trust me? Justin replied. Faber only smiled and shook his head. Still smiling, he strolled away, stopping to speak at another tableful of diners. Justin finished his meal, finding it a little tastier than he had a few minutes ago, seasoned with something like friendship. The next day was extremely chilly but bright with sun. Dells was sick, so Justin handled the stables by himself. He didn't mind the extra work, for he still felt driven by that instinct to act, to stay in motion. When he'd finished with the normal chores, he began working at the tasks they never got to, sweeping out the main room, hammering down a loose board, replacing a smashed stall gate that had been kicked in by a fractious horse. Dark had long since fallen, and he had run out of make-work when he heard one of the front doors creak open. He was in the back half of the building, checking a gelding's legs for nicks, and he lifted his head and waited to be summoned. But no one called for an ostler. There was no sound of footfalls, either human or horse, from the main room. Maybe the wind had just blown the door back. Justin didn't think so. He released the gelding's foot, backed out of the stall, and silently latched the gate. His dagger was already in his hand. There was a lantern lit in here, but the front room would be dark. Anyone could be lurking in the shadows. Who had come calling? Convent guards, not deceived by Justin's air of innocence? Faber and his men, not so fond of mystics and their champions after all. A thief, come to steal a saddle or a traveler's horse? Justin moved noiselessly across the floor, paused at the connecting doors, and listened closely. Someone was breathing, hard and fast, as if he'd been running, or sobbing. There was a rustle of clothing, the sound of a body dropping onto a bale of hay, as if it was the softest, safest sanctuary in the world. More rustling, as if a cloak had been unwrapped, or a skirt had been rearranged. A long sigh, half-vocalized, the voice sounding in the upper register. A woman waited on the other side of the doors. Justin wasn't stupid enough to think all women were useless in a fight. He knew plenty who weren't. But there were only a handful of people who could beat him in one-on-one combat, and none of them were female. He didn't think he would risk much by confronting this one head-on. In three swift movements, he'd snatched the lantern from its hook, swung open the connecting doors, and burst into the main room. The woman sitting there leapt to her feet, one hand pressed to her heart, one pressed to her mouth, and visibly held back a scream. They stared at each other. Justin didn't know what he'd expected, but it wasn't this woman. Small, pale, blonde, and very clearly noble. She huddled inside a thick, fur-lined coat and stared at him, eyes wide with terror. The look on her face said she knew he was going to kill her. He lowered his dagger but kept the lantern lifted high.
"Who are you?" he asked in a quiet voice. She shook her head and didn't answer.
I won't hurt you, he said, though he found himself wondering how many attackers claimed the same thing seconds before they leapt forward to cut someone's throat. You look afraid. Is someone coming after you? Someone who wants to harm you?
She dropped her hand from her mouth, but kept her other hand balled up against her throat. Or, no. She was clutching something in her fingers, a necklace or an amulet, perhaps.
My husband, she whispered. He wants me dead.
Time to get practical. How many men does he have with him? What direction did you come from?
She opened her mouth as if to speak, but no words came out. Clearly, she was not used to good fortune. She wouldn't believe she could trust him.
Justin made his voice softer. He kept remembering how Cammon had told him not to intimidate Dells. This lady was probably even more unnerved by his size and ferocity.
How close are they? Do you have a guess?
She moistened her lips.
I don't know. No one was paying attention, so I just left. I don't know when they got back or when they started to miss me.
Where were you? Did you come on foot?
Yes. Well, someone gave me a ride in a cart this afternoon. I was walking yesterday.
So she'd been on the run or in hiding for a full day or more. He wondered what had made her trust the driver of the gig.
Where were you? He repeated.
She tried twice before she could answer. Her eyes were desperately scanning his face, trying to read in it some promise of compassion.
The convent, she said.
The Luminan convent? He repeated, more forcefully than he intended.
She swayed backward and almost fell over the bale of hay. What in the name of all the goddesses in Gilengaria was drawing half the nobility of the realm to this one small corner of Nochlin?
Yes, she whispered. I was there with my husband.
And your husband is? He said, but his voice trailed off.
He studied her. He had seen her before. He knew he had. Dressed in a fine gown and gracing some sumptuous ballroom, but looking just as fragile and afraid as she did right now. And more recently, here in Neft, standing in a tavern with a group of soldiers who had ridden in with
Helkon Gieseltes, he said abruptly,
and the terror on her face ratcheted up a notch.
You're his wife.
She didn't answer. He thought fear might kill her where she stood.
You don't have to be afraid of me, he said, trying to remember the tale.
He sat down a few yards away from her on a rickety stool and set the lantern near his feet. They had been in Nochlin last summer, Seneth guarding Princess Amelie, Kira and Queen Valerie along to give her consequence, Justin and Taze and two other riders there to protect the women, and Helkon Gieseltes had shown up at a grand ball, with his wife at his side. He was, of course, supposed to be under arrest at Giesel Plain. Soon enough, the regent had produced enough royal soldiers to send the errant Marlord and his wife back to their estates. But before they had left, Halcon's wife had managed to meet with Seneth and whisper secrets about the war her husband was planning. So that was a name the shivering Marlady might recognize.
I won't hurt you, he said again. I'm a king's rider. I'm a friend of Seneth's.
It was the talisman he'd hoped. She caught her breath and then seemed to crumple, falling all in a heap back on the bale of hay, her hands over her eyes, her whole body shaking. By the bright mother's red eye, she was crying. What was he supposed to do now?
We don't have time for tears, he said, raising his voice a little so she could hear him over the sound of her weeping. We have to figure out how to keep you safe.
I'm not safe. I'll never be safe, she said on a sob. He'll find me and he'll kill me and I don't know what to do. I'm so tired. I'm so tired of being afraid.
Well, he'll find you for certain if you're here, Justin said, not wanting to sound unsympathetic, but wanting her to pay attention.
Stables will be the first place he and his men come looking. We have to find some place less likely.
It doesn't matter, she said hopelessly.
She seemed to have stopped crying, but Justin couldn't see that this brightened her attitude any.
He'll find me, no matter where I go.
He shook his head. Not if we're smart. Not if we hide you before anybody sees you. His voice trailed off again as he considered and discarded options. Obviously, he would have to take her to his room. She was much too exposed in the stables, and she would attract notice if she tried to rent a room for herself. But how to transport her from here to there? She was about the same size as Eleanor. She could borrow Dells's clothes, as Eleanor had, except the clothes were off their accustomed hook, taken home for cleaning, he supposed. He could parade her boldly through the front rooms of the house, pretending she was a doxy he'd brought home for the night, though that might seem out of character, since he hadn't indulged in such entertainment in all the weeks he'd lived here. He could try to sneak her into the house, hoping he encountered no one on the stairs, but any air of furtiveness was sure to draw attention just when he didn't want it. "Here's what we're going to do," he said. "I've got a room in a building not far from here. You're going to walk there, openly, head up, not looking around like you're afraid someone's going to grab you from behind. You'll go in the front door. If anyone looks at you, just nod your head like you know right where you're going. If someone asks you if you need help, say, 'I'm picking something up for a friend.' If they ask who, tell them Justin. You'll take my key." He dug it out of his pocket and passed it to her in an underhand throw. She actually caught it. "You'll go up to my room, and you'll let yourself in, and then you'll wait for me. I'll come in 20 or 30 minutes later so no one sees us together," he considered. "It would be better if you didn't have to use my name," he conceded. "But don't get flustered. If someone asks who you're seeing, just be nonchalant. Just act like you don't have a thought of trouble in your head."
"Is that your name?" she asked timidly. "Justin?"
He nodded.
She said, "I'm Sabina."
That made him smile at her because it was so politely said. The expression she showed him was almost an answering smile. "Don't worry, Sabina. Everything will be all right." She nodded.
"When you come, would it be possible? Is there any chance you could bring some food?"
"Good idea. I'll stop by the tap room and pick up something to eat." He looked around. "If you're that hungry, I've got an apple in here somewhere."
"Yes," she said.
He rose, crossed the room, and dug through the pockets of his overcoat to find the fruit. She took it from his hand and bit into it instantly, daintily enough, but clearly starving. He'd have to bring her more than bread and cheese if he could manage it. "Let me know when you're ready to go," he said. "I'll tell you exactly how to get to my place. And don't worry, I'll just be a few feet behind you. If someone tries to grab you, I'll be at your side in a couple of seconds." She nodded, but did not answer. She was still eating. Her free hand crept up again to close around her necklace. He had had a chance to see what it was, though. An onyx stone, set with a small garnet. Pretty, and probably valuable. Unexpectedly, she noticed that something had caught his attention and even figured out what it was. She swallowed the last bite of apple, licked juice from her fingers, and gave him the faintest smile.
"She was right, after all," she said.
He was lost. "Who was? Right about what?"
"Seneth. She told me she could enchant my pendant. She told me that if I took hold of it when I was afraid and weak, that I would find comfort and strength. Seneth laid her hands on this worthless symbol of Giseltess and made it the very thing that would save my life."
She gazed at him with a great deal of intensity.
"It led me to you, to her friend. It has kept me safe, just as she promised."
Well, now, that was something he'd have to ask Seneth about sometime. He'd never seen magic transferred to inanimate objects before. Then again, he had come to accept, as an article of faith, that Seneth could do pretty much anything she wanted to. and anything that helped keep Sabina Gieseltest calm had to be something he approved of.
Excellent, he said. Are you ready? Let me tell you where you're going.
Chapter 21. Justin and the Mar Lady slipped out into the darkness, the crooked streets in this part of Neft lit only randomly by the few shops and houses where candlelight glowed through the windows. He had thought she might be too rattled to remember his instructions and was prepared to repeat them several times, but she had listened carefully and repeated them back to him without a mistake. He let her get a few yards ahead of him, then crossed to the other side of the street, appearing to stroll casually along, glancing in windows, nodding at passers-by. No one molested the Mar Lady, though one or two passing men gave her suggestive smiles or offered a warm greeting. She didn't let them distract her. She walked on, her posture very straight, her face no doubt drawn in concentration. Within 10 minutes they were at the boarding house, and Justin idled by. Not too far. He wanted to be within sight if she came rushing out, if some part of his plan failed. He allowed her enough time to climb the 2 flights of steps at a fairly slow pace, pausing to have a brief conversation once or twice, and then come running back downstairs in a panic. But she did not emerge. So he hied himself over to the tap room, groused that he'd had to work late and, damn, wouldn't have time for lunch tomorrow. Could someone wrap him up some meat and bread and maybe some cheese? Another 10 minutes, and he had a couple of fairly hearty meals put together and was back on the street. Back in the boarding house. A few souls were gathered in the common room, but no one looked up from the card game when he stepped in. He bounded up the stairs, knocked twice on his own door, and stepped inside. The room was in darkness, but he could instantly see the small shadow that was Sabina Gieseltes pressed against the far wall. "It's Justin," he said, in case she couldn't tell. "Did you have any trouble?" She came toward him.
"No, I didn't speak to anyone at all. There were some men downstairs when I came in, but they looked like they were gambling, and they didn't pay any attention to me."
"Good. Draw the curtains, and I'll find a candle. Then you can eat. Then we can talk things over."
In a few minutes, he'd lit 2 candles, built up the fire, a luxury he rarely bothered with, but he'd paid for the wood already, so why not, and laid out Sabina's meal. In no time at all, she was sitting on the floor before the hearth, eating her 2nd piece of bread and actually smiling, warm and fed and more or less safe for the first time since she'd left her husband's care. Justin guessed she was probably on the edge of euphoria.
"Now, we have to figure out what to do next," Justin said.
The room offered no furniture, besides a dilapidated chest of drawers and the 2 beds, and he felt a little peculiar sitting on a bed while he was entertaining a woman he didn't know, particularly a Mar Lady. So he just dropped to the floor and sat facing her.
"You can stay here a few days, but you'll need to find a more secure destination, and we'll have to decide how to get you there."
She swallowed a piece of meat. "I was thinking probably I should go to Gosenhall and meet with King Baron."
Justin nodded.
"And if you can tell him what your husband's been up to lately, I'm sure he'll be even happier to see you. But Gosenhall's a pretty far trek for a lone woman on foot. How are we going to get you there?"
She took another bite and waited. Clearly, she wasn't the one who was going to try to come up with plans. Another messenger should come from Gosenhall soon enough. Maybe this one would be a rider. Would it be safe to send Sabina Gieseltes back to the royal city with only a single armed escort? Justin reviewed the likely envoys. With Taze or Tyr or Hammond or Koval, yes. With himself, of course. But he wasn't sure he would trust any other solitary soldier, even a rider, to protect this particular cargo for such a long journey. Well, then, he'd just keep the runaway wife safe in his room and send an urgent message back with whoever came calling. That would disrupt his life for days, maybe weeks, longer than he'd like, but there didn't seem to be much choice about it.
"I think maybe you'd just better stay here until I can get a message to the king," he said. "Might be a week or more, and you'll have to stay out of sight that whole time, but I think it will be safest. She nodded.
I don't care. I'll sit in this room a year if I have to, just to be free of him.
Her voice broke off. Justin nodded. I've met him once or twice. Not a man I'd care to spend much time with.
I've been married to him more than 15 years, she whispered.
He didn't know what to say in answer to that. So, I'll bring you food and water every day. You'll have to stay quiet, take off your shoes, glide across the floor when you walk. I'll show you the boards that creak. No one comes up here because that's how I got cheap rent. I haul the wood and the water and take down the linens every couple of weeks. That bed, he added, pointing, is the one I haven't slept in, so it's got clean sheets. Well, Cammon slept in it twice, so...
I don't care, she said again. I would have slept in the stables. I would have slept in the woods. I can't believe I'm so lucky as to be inside, warm, taken care of. I can't tell you. I can't thank you.
He was afraid she'd start crying again. Don't. I'm in service to the king, and he will reward me, I promise you, for taking you in. He knows Helcon Giseltas is his enemy, and he can use you as a weapon against him. I'm just acting on the king's behalf. She swiped at her eyes.
I think you're better than that, she said in a low voice. I think you would have helped me anyway.
He was silent, thinking about that. A year ago, he might not have, probably would not have, unless he had been able to see instantly how this frail Marlady could so quickly become a dagger in the king's hand. He wouldn't have turned her over to the Giseltas soldiers. He might even have let her sleep in the stables, but he wouldn't have rescued her, wouldn't have thought it was important enough to do. Seneth had changed him. Seneth, who tried to save everybody, no matter how insignificant. Seneth, who had no sense of priorities. She would jeopardize her mission for the king in order to keep some peasant girl from dying. Until Justin had seen Seneth fight for the nameless and the wretched, it had not occurred to him that anyone would choose to do so. That he could do so. And be damn good at it, just because he was so good at fighting. He rose to his feet. I'm going to get a change of clothes and head on back to the stables to sleep. Lock the door behind me. I'll check on you in the morning. Now alarm returned to the face that had looked briefly content and actually pretty.
You're going to leave me?
He was surprised. I thought you'd rather... You don't know me, and it's a small room.
Please. You'll be more comfortable in your own bed, and I think I'll be less afraid if you're here. I understand you'll be gone during the day, but at night, tonight at least, if you'd stay.
He could hardly refuse. He had no problem sleeping with a stranger nearby. He could wake in an instant if someone came creeping toward him in the night bent on murder. Not that he thought she would. Not that she even had a weapon that he'd seen. Still... He was confident in his ability to repulse her if he had to. All right, then. I'll stay, he said, and her thin shoulders relaxed in relief.
Thank you, she whispered. I will never be able to repay you.
A few minutes later, as they blew out the candles and took to their separate beds, Justin thought that over, too. What kind of payment would he ask for? If Sabina Giseltas had the power to grant it, or if the gods decided to liquidate human debts and level all accounts, what kind of reward would he request? He wasn't much for material things. A fast horse and a set of good blades were the only things he really cared about, so he wouldn't particularly want gold. He loved his life as a rider, so he wouldn't ask for land. He had friends. He had status of a sort. All he wanted was for Eleanor to be safe, for the gods to guide her to shelter and a champion as surely as they had guided Sabina Giseltas to him. If he believed in the gods, he might now think he had the right to ask them a favor. Bright Mother,
Black Mother, Pale Mother, whichever one watches over Eleanor, keep her safe tonight. Keep her safe, always. He heard Sabina rustle in her bed, and he listened, in case she was about to ask him for something, but she said nothing. He put a hand briefly to his forehead, thinking about everything that had happened in the past week, everything